So we started a small community garden on community land up by the hall, community hall. That was in 2012. And we did a lot of promotion amongst the locals. First of all, we wanted to find out if people wanted to have a community garden. And then we worked on that for about 3 months, letting people know what we had in mind. A place for people to garden, grow organic food, to get together, share information, and a good community space. So then finally we thought, okay, let's bite the bullet. It's D-Day, and we called a community working bee. Well, we were just amazed. 50 people came to help us set up our community garden. It was amazing. We had builders came and built us compost heaps. We needed a water tank. Somebody donated us a water tank. The builders built us a tank stand. The local sawmill donated us garden edging. The hardware store across the road gave us nails and things for the garden edging. So we created this garden in a day. It was just fabulous. And since then, it's gone from strength to strength. In the beginning, the soil was very, very poor. So we had to build it up, increase the life in the soil, increase the microorganisms. And we did that. And now it's a highly productive garden. And we do our gardening, we garden all together. We don't have our own separate plots.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. In the studio this morning, I have Trish Allen, and she with her late husband, Joe Palacia, had Rainbow Valley Farms up in Matakana here north of Auckland, and it was one of the most profound little permaculture farms in New Zealand. So, kia ora, Trish. Thank you for coming in here and sharing with me.
Hello, Tim. Thank you for having me.
Trish, you've got a wonderful story. There was a little bit of sadness in it as well, and yet you have continued to want to tend the garden, for want of a better word, and make sure that all the great learnings that you and husband Joe came to whilst you transformed Rainbow Valley into a fantastic permaculture farm, that all these teachings continue and flourish. So would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about this little oasis up north?
Yes. Well, I think, Tim, that once you've been bitten by the permaculture bug, you've got it for life. There's no other way. So Joe and I got bitten by the permaculture bug way back in about 1984. Joe came home one day with a book that someone had given him, Permaculture One, and he was all excited about it because it brought together under one umbrella all the different streams of ecological wisdom that we were interested in. So we got busy studying permaculture, found out everything that it meant. And we were really inspired because permaculture is solutions-based. There's so much bad things happening on our planet, but permaculture is hopeful. It's empowering. So that's really what inspired us. So we were very keen to put it into practice. So that started a 25-year-long adventure that Joe and I had together. We found this piece of run-down farmland in Matakana. It had a bit of a sad history. We bought it because it was cheap. We could afford it. The early European settlers had come in and cut down all the forest off those deep hills. But this is rainforest land. The soils are very fragile. So without that forest cover, the little bit of topsoil that there was washed down into the stream and out into the harbour. So it was very, very poor soil, very little soil. and it was infested with weeds, pests, and eroded. As I said, we bought it because it was cheap, we could afford it, but we saw this as an amazing opportunity to restore this land, bring back fertility, and that's what we did over 25 years. We turned it into a little permaculture paradise. So in the beginning, we just did it for ourselves. We wanted to have a low ecological footprint. We wanted to grow our own food organically with no pesticides. We wanted to get the microorganisms back in the soil. Yeah, so in the beginning, it was just for us. But more and more people got interested in what we were doing. And over time, we got more and more visitors. And so we started to do education on the farm. And then we got all the local school classes used to come up. And then universities, unitechs came. And of course, when we built our house, which was a non-toxic house, we made the mud bricks ourselves. We had an earth roof, and it was the first earth roof mud-walled house in Rodney. So, of course, that attracted a lot of interest from architects and designers. And so we started to run all kinds of workshops on the farm, mud brick making, compost toilet making, shingles and shakes, obviously composting, worm farming, all kinds of workshops. And then we ran introduction to permaculture courses and also permaculture design courses, the two-week intensive design courses. The first workshop that we ever ran way back in 1991 was one on how to reduce your household rubbish, a zero-waste workshop. And that's been an enduring theme with me, and this is something that I'm still doing 31 years later. I'm working in this field.
Yes, it's really interesting because I came to one of your open weekends and I saw things there that I thought, wow, boy, is it time for us to get involved and start realizing, closing the loop, making sure that there's no more waste anymore.
Yes, yes, definitely. Everything that we generated on the farm, we used. We wasted nothing. So we started off, as I said, with very, very little soil. And our biggest job in the beginning was to grow soil, to grow the microorganisms in the soil. Over time, we planted 800 fruit and nut trees. We had...
That's a lot.
Yeah. Yes, yes. We also were involved in starting the farmers market in Matakana Village. So that was very successful for us.
It still is.
It's gone from strength to strength.
Today you can still go to the Matakana Village and boy, it's pumping in the morning, isn't it? Saturday mornings.
Sure is. And we had bees. We used to sell honey on the farmers market. We used to sell fruit, vegetables, plants, flowers, eggs, just about everything that we produced on the farm. And also we did some interesting experiments on the farm. Joe used to call it his university. So he wanted to grow rice. So we started off, we did a lot of experiments. The first ones weren't very successful, but eventually we had a very successful rice paddy. Quite small. We produced about 50 kilos of rice per year. And that was pretty unusual in the north as well.
Very much so.
And Joe loved mushrooms in Europe, in Austria, where he came from. It's a national pastime to go mushroom hunting in the forest. And we don't have so many edible ones in New Zealand. So we built this mushroom house, which was actually two rows of willows tied together at the top, planted the willows, so that it grew in a kind of house shape, creating a shady environment next to the stream, shady, moist environment, quite humid. And so we inoculated logs with shiitake boars. So we had quite a big production of shiitake mushrooms, namiko, and also oyster mushrooms. But the shiitake were the most successful.
When I was there, that was a thing that caught my attention as well. All these mushrooms just growing out of these logs. It was amazing.
And they taste so good. Such good food. Yeah. We also had the animals. We had house cows. We'd milk the cow every morning, have fresh milk from which we'd make yogurt and cheese and butter. We had sheep, pigs, and just about all the birds you could imagine. Chickens, ducks, guinea fowl, pigeons, turkeys. It was a real old McDonald's farm.
Back in about 1990, there's a property right next door to your place with a big puriri tree.
Yes.
Well, I had an option to buy that, and I missed it by half an hour.
Oh, wow.
Because I wanted to go in and do a Findhorn-type experiment working with the land, and looking at this land, realised it had a lot of kaikuya. And so I'd gone over to your place and met Joe, and he had these kuni-kuni pigs. And he said, oh, look, he said, this is one way we can get at the kaikuya. And so, yes, and that was my... It came so close because I really wanted to work in with you when I saw that was going on.
How amazing that would have been, Tim.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, that puriri tree was so important to me as well. It sort of anchored everything. And so I missed it by half an hour and I was just quite devastated, really.
Wow, yeah.
Yes, so with your animals, the kuni-kuni pigs, not many people know about them. They've got a different little sort of like a tassel hanging from their head.
Yeah, they're very cute looking pigs. They tend to have very short legs, short snouts, and they have these cute little tassels hanging off their cheeks. And they're very, very tame and very lovable. And we use them to control the kikuyu because we didn't want to use any chemicals, of course. And so they used to eat and fertilize and prepare the land for our orchards. Yeah, it was one of the ways that we could build soil fertility.
See, this is the important thing, is that your animals can work along with you. You know, the ducks can get rid of snails and etc. And fertilizer from poultry is always very, very powerful fertilizer. So the whole process is an immersion, really.
Yes, that's right. That's one of the principles of permaculture. Use and value biological resources. So we had the pigs doing the work rather than a machine that guzzled fossil fuels, unrenewable fossil fuels. Pigs and chickens and ducks and guinea fowl, the birds, the poultry, they were part of our integrated pest management system. They ate the bugs, the snails, they fertilized. So when you can have an animal doing the work using its natural behaviour, why would you want to intervene with a machine that uses unrenewable resources like fossil fuels? So that's one of the important principles of permaculture. This is one of the things that inspired us so much about permaculture. And we experimented with putting all of those permaculture principles into action on the farm. And I think that's why it became so well known worldwide, because people could come there having read the permaculture ethics and principles, and then they'd see our place and they'd see what that looks like on the ground when you actually apply it.
Very true. When I looked at the house that you had built, it was so cozy. And all the flowers and the garden all around it, it was sort of like some mythical little story, really. It was wonderful. And then you had your fire and you had a wetback and you could cook. But the wetback was really important. And New Zealanders don't know much about them. I was born on a farm, and our fireplace at the back, we had some pipes where water would come from the cold water tank, and these pipes were in behind where the flame and the fire was. And so the heat of a fire would warm the water in the pipes, and the heat would push it up the hot water cylinder into the hot water cupboard. And that's why we were able to have real cheap hot water for our house, solely because we could depend on a fire. So wetback's important.
Yes, we had those on the farm exactly for the reasons that you said. And this is another principle of permaculture, multiple functions. So every function should have multiple elements. And so if you need to have a fire to warm your house, well, you might as well cook with that heat as well. And you might as well warm your water with it as well. And so we light the fire, cook on the stove, heat the water all at the same time. Yes, yeah, so the whole principle of our house was passive solar design. We wanted to have an energy efficient house. And so we designed it for passive solar gain. That is a passive solar house. In winter, we wanted to maximise the amount of sun that shone into the house, and we did that by the angle of the eaves. So when the winter sun is lower in the sky, it shone into the house and warmed up the tiles and mud walls and stored that heat, so it was a heat sink. But in summer, when it was hot, we wanted to exclude the sun to keep the house nice and cool. So again, the angle of the eaves was such that the summer sun was excluded, and it was lovely and cool in the summer.
Very much so, because you had grass on your roof as well. Yes,
we did. We had earth on the roof with plants growing on top. And Joe used to say, we're collecting honey from our roof because we've got all these flowers for the bees. And the principle of that was, well, we're robbing Mother Nature of an area when we build the house, so we wanted to put that back up on top for the insects and the bees. Also, it was very good insulation, and it looked beautiful.
It certainly did. Because you're using the four tenets of care for the earth, care for people, share the resources, and limit consumption. And so these are all embedded principles.
The embedded principles of permaculture that everything is based on. That's right.
Yeah. And I just want to say that Bill Mollison and David Holmgren were the ones who started this ball rolling. And they did it out of Tasmania, is that right?
Yes, that's right. Bill Mollison was a professor at a university in Tasmania, and David Holmgren was one of his students. And they developed this concept of permaculture, permanent agriculture or permanent culture. So they developed it in 1977, and now it's just gone worldwide.
It certainly has. As you say, once you walk on the land, notice where the arc of the sun is in summer and winter, see where the winds are, and see how you can use water to basically gravity feed down to your dwelling. You become one with nature.
That's right. It's very much based on nature and working with nature, not against nature, and maximising the benefits of working with nature. Like you said, Tim, we had springs high up on our land, so we were able to gravity feed the water down to our house and our water troughs for the animals without using any fossil fuels. So that was part of the permaculture philosophy of energy efficiency.
And, of course, no chlorinated water and no fluoridated water. And this is the beauty of living off the land, whereas in the city it's a different story. Mm. It's nowhere near as healthy. And so I encourage people to look at ways that you can involve yourself with permaculture, even if you are in the city. Just bring some of these principles into play.
Yes, there's many ways you can get involved, because permaculture is not just about growing food. Many people think it is, but it's a much, much wider subject. It's about create no waste. It's not just about minimising waste, it's about not creating it in the first place. So there's many ways you can get involved in one of it, which is growing food in a community garden, or there's lots of social permaculture systems around, social places that you can get involved in permaculture. And even in Auckland City, there's like Kalmana Gardens, for example, in the middle of Grey Lynn, and there's permaculture courses happening all over Auckland.
This is true. I mean, Kalmana is one of the sort of gems of the city. It's been going for, I don't know, nearly 40, 50-odd years. And we must remember that there are some pioneers like you, Trish, who have been out there, who have been doing this type of thing to just anchor the idea that nature is where we spring from.
That we're very much part of nature, Tim.
Yes. And Trish, you do run these courses now, and at the moment you've got numerous different courses. Can we just go back on the waste theme? Because I know it's dear to you, and I can assure you it's dear to me, because we need to realise that we don't want to have a trash planet. We want to close the loop and make sure that everything that comes out of the earth is used appropriately and then return back in as harmonious way as we can.
That's right, Tim. Joe always used to say that our current consumer society, our throwaway society, is not sustainable. We mine the planet. We extract resources from the planet, we use them badly, and we throw them away as waste and pollution, and that has to change. And I think there's just so much more awareness now. I'm really delighted that Auckland Council's new waste management and minimisation plan has some very, very good principles in it. So up in my area, I've just formed a charitable trust called Mahurangi Wastebusters. And our mission is to divert waste from landfill, recover resources, recycle, repair, and basically what we've been doing so far has been waste education. So we have run 2 how to reduce your household rubbish courses in the last 18 months, which have been well attended by the community. People are really interested to know how they can do that. And we've got some more coming up that we're planning. We've run one repair cafe where people come along. The repair cafe movement is worldwide now. It started in Holland in 2009. So you get a group of enthusiastic volunteers together who have skills in repairing things. You make a date and you invite the public to come along and bring things that are broken that they would normally just have to throw away, and it would go to landfill in New Zealand. So maybe it's a toaster, maybe it's a chair with a broken leg, maybe it's a bicycle that needs a little bit of repairs and maintenance. That people bring their things along and our enthusiastic, friendly volunteers help them to fix it and show them how to fix it. So we're not only repairing things and avoiding them being thrown away to go into a landfill, a big hole in the ground, we're also sharing skills, which is really important, and it's very community building. So not only is that an important part of it to repair things, but the cafe side of it is also important. So we have other lovely volunteers who bake beautiful home baking and bring it along, and we serve tea and coffee and you can have a chat with other people. We've got a knife sharpener coming along to sharpen people's knives. We've got lots of sewers coming along to do mending and darning. And we've got some bicycle experts coming along, some good handymen who can fix chair legs or broken toys. The biggest thing that comes out of these, what everybody says every time, apart from getting their thing repaired, they enjoy the community spirit and being part of a community working together.
I agree. It's a lot of fun. You meet new people. The interesting thing I find, Trish, is the people who are involved, they're really good-hearted.
They are.
And they're honest.
They are.
And they love their kids. And we just want to hang out and be with each other. I know, just further out, a couple of kilometres away from you, Tarawhanui, I go and I plant trees. And I recently just went out there among the community. I planted some trees one Sunday and flew away to Europe in an aeroplane. And then I came back and I went and I planted another lot of trees to be able to sequester my CO2 emissions out of the atmosphere. So these little things, because it was all community-oriented, the tree planting, all volunteers, we had over 4,500 trees in one day. Well, this is fantastic.
That's an amazing project out there at Tawharanui. I think they're doing wonderful work. Yeah.
Yes.
And just going back to Mahurangi Wastebusters, the other thing we've started to do, we've done 2 now, is managing the waste at local community events so that we are aiming for zero waste. So we've done 2 little festivals and we managed 96% diversion from landfill. We were very proud of that. It took a lot of work, but we were very excited about it. We managed to all the food waste from the festival, we composted on one of our members' farms. they were super excited about getting this massive big compost built on their farm. And so we were able to recycle all the bottles and all that kind of thing. So that was a very high percentage diversion, and we were very proud of it. So as I said, we've been concentrating on education up till now, but we'd very much like to set up community recycling centres in our region along the lines of the wonderful ones that are happening in other parts of New Zealand, like
Raglan.
Extreme Zero Waste in Raglan. They're an inspiration, and they've been going for 20 years, and we're looking at them and thinking, yes, that's what we need in our area.
It's infectious. Really, really wonderful. I've done an interview of Warren Snow as well around zero waste, and he's looking at the whole country. Yes. And it's a big challenge for him, whereas you're starting on a micro level, because at heart we all know grassroots is where the change is going to come.
Yes, and I think that's the good thing about doing something local. You know, as I said before, it's so easy to get a little bit down on all the bad things that are happening. But when you can actually do something, you feel so much better. And where to do it? Well, why not right where you are at home? Yeah.
Did you get a video of your recent 96% diversion? What you did with that whole process of being able to clean out the waste stream so that you only had 4% left?
Not a video, but I do have lots of photographs of it.
I think this is another good thing for us to do in the future, is to have somebody do a video of it, because they can then see exactly what's happening, they can hear the laughter as well, and just really get the vibe.
Yes, that's something for us to bear in mind, yeah.
And you're also working with Snell's Beach as well?
Yes, that's one of the places we would like to set up a community recycling centre, yeah.
And you have a good relationship with Auckland Council, with the sustainability people in the council, so that they can come out if somebody from Clevedon or somebody out in West Auckland wanted to do what you're doing, they could open up a dialogue with somebody in council?
We're definitely open to talking with anybody, so yes, definitely, yeah.
Oh, okay, so that could come back straight to you instead of maybe going to the council?
Yes.
Oh, okay, yep. Very good.
Oh, I have to tell you about Matakana Community Garden. So when I left the farm, which was a couple of years after, sadly, Joe passed away, I found the farm, which was 50 acres, too much to manage by myself. Joe was such an energetic man. So I sold the farm and moved to the village, and I created a new little permaculture paradise on a quarter of an acre. So I had a new house built, and in my new quarter acre, I put into practice all the knowledge that I'd gained over 25 years on Rainbow Valley Farm. So I had a wooden house built this time, sustainable wood, of course, grown in the area, macrocarpa, and passive solar design, the roof design to exclude summer sun, to let the winter sun in, windows on the right sides. And I had solar panels installed to create my own electricity. And, of course, in summer I create too much power, so it goes back into the grid. So I'm supplying the national grid with power.
Excuse me, was that easy to arrange?
Very easy, yes.
Oh, very good. I'm really glad to hear that whatever the New Zealand Electricity Department, I know it's not that name, but that they're prepared to now take that back, because this is a big shift, isn't it?
It is a big shift. They don't pay you much for the power that you export. So when you export the power, they pay you wholesale rates for it. But in winter, if you don't have enough power on a day that has no sun and you have to import power, you pay for that at retail rates. But still, my power bill is still very, very low.
And $30 a month, I've heard.
$30 a month, yeah. Average.
Average, yeah, okay. Yes.
So I also have solar panels to heat my hot water. And in winter when it's not sunny and my hot water's not getting heated, of course, it's usually cool. So I light my fire and I have my wood burner and with a wet back so I can cook on it, heat the room and heat the hot water when the sun's not shining. So it's all very integrated. It works so well.
I know that if I can drive down from the city, from the rural sector or the beach where we are, because I'm not far from you, Trish, I can come into the city and I can smell wood that has been burnt, and I can smell some that has been treated as well. And, so do you have some sort of scrubber or do you not have a vent to allow the fire to cause a lot of smoke? How does this work, do you
now,
know?
Now, this is a very, very important point. I never, never burn tantalised or wood that has been treated with any kind of chemicals. That's a no-no. And then the firewood must be dry. To burn wet wood is to pollute the atmosphere. So my firewood is cut and stored for more than a year and dried perfectly dry before I burn it. And also, with the new Clean Air Act, the wood burners that you buy when you live in a village or a town, you can't dampen them down.
That's the word.
Yeah, they're not allowed to be. So my fire, it burns hot and dry with my nice dry firewood, creates a lot of heat, and because my house is so well insulated, then the fire goes out and it's perfectly comfortable and warm. I don't have to keep the fire going.
And when you get up in the morning, the house is still warm.
Still warm. Good insulation is highly, highly important.
So you've got wool insulation in your house at the moment, is that right?
Yes, I've got wool insulation in the walls. I wanted to support New Zealand sheep farmers. But in the ceiling, I have the insulation. I think it's called green stuff, but it's made from recycled plastic bottles. So I thought I'd support the recycling industry as well.
So is this chopped up or nearly shredded into small, like a very, very thin fibre?
Yes, it's like a felt. It's made to be like, it almost looks like felt.
Oh, so it's really, really super thin. It's nearly like wool.
It's like wool and it's made into big, thick bats. Yeah.
Well, boy, that's one way we can do it, isn't it? And because there's no sunlight up there, it won't break down.
That's right, yes. So also on my little new permaculture paradise on quarter of an acre, I've managed to squeeze in 50 fruit trees.
That's a huge amount.
I've got just about everything. I've got feijoas, peaches, pears, apricots, figs, Casimiroa, cherry moya, olives, what else? Bananas.
Pineapple?
No pineapple.
Not yet.
Well, we get frosts in winter, so I'd have to have a glass house, and I haven't got one yet.
I see. Yes, well, again, I mean, when you're picking this fruit, as the months go by and the seasons change, you're just blending from one season to another. And you've got continuous, shall we say, vitamin C coming into your body.
Absolutely. Oh, I started to talk about the Matakana Community Garden and I didn't finish that. So when I moved from the farm to the village, a friend approached me and said, let's start a community garden in Matakana. Her name was Robin. So I thought, oh, why not? She actually had to convince me because I wasn't sure it would work. But she was really enthusiastic, so I said, okay, let's give it a go. So we started a small community garden on community land up by the hall, community hall. That was in 2012. And we did a lot of promotion amongst the locals. First of all, we wanted to find out if people wanted to have a community garden. And then we worked on that for about 3 months, letting people know what we had in mind. A place for people to garden, grow organic food, to get together, share information, and a good community space. So then finally we thought, okay, let's bite the bullet. it's D-Day, and we called a community working bee. Well, we were just amazed. 50 people came to help us set up our community garden. It was amazing. We had builders came and built us compost heaps. We needed a water tank. Somebody donated us a water tank. The builders built us a tank stand. The local sawmill donated us garden edging. The hardware store across the road gave us nails and things for the garden edging. So we created this garden in a day. It was just fabulous. And since then, it's gone from strength to strength. In the beginning, the soil was very, very poor. So we had to build it up, increase the life in the soil, increase the microorganisms. And we did that. And now it's a highly productive little garden. We've expanded it twice. It's still not huge, but it's really productive. And we have a working bee Monday mornings, 9 till 10:30. And probably between 6 and 15 people show up every week. And we do our gardening. We garden all together. We don't have our own separate plots. And we harvest, we plant, we water, we weed. And then at 10:30, we all go off and have a coffee together.
Or you can have herbal teas from your own garden.
We could. We could, yeah.
I'm speaking with Trish Allen, who, with her late husband, Joe Palacia, was the founder of the permaculture Rainbow Valley Farm in Matakana. Trish, I'm very interested in soil microflora, the bacteria and the fungi. I get a lot of seaweed from Martin's Bay because it's in a clear water area, and so the seaweed is very, very pure from the standpoint of ocean minerals. Do you collect your... Do you collect this, or there's seagrass also at Snell's Beach, which is also another wonderful resource? Is there any little hint that you could give to people about building up their soil? Because I know that you mentioned with mulch has been a really important, hot weather, got to make sure that everything underneath is moist and alive.
Exactly. Well, we're scavengers, actually. We come over there to Martin's Bay, Snell's Beach, Algie's Bay, and we collect that seagrass. It's wonderful. It has all those micronutrients in it, great for the soil. And we put that through our compost, or sometimes we mulch it directly. And we get donated donkey poo and chicken poo mixed with shavings from the animal sanctuary up the road from us. And we donate them plants that have gone to seed for their animals. So we have a great little system going on. There's also a kombucha factory in the village. And they need to get rid of the tea, the spent tea, after they've made the kombucha. So a tiny little forklift trundles down once a week from the kombucha factory and delivers us a wheelie bin, or sometimes two wheelie bins a week, of the tea, which is usually smelling beautiful of all the lovely cinnamon and nutmeg and lovely herbs. And so we put that through our compost as well, or sometimes we mulch it a little bit on the gardens as well. So we get all kinds of stuff, yes.
Do you get wood shavings and, yes, and sawdust?
Not so much sawdust, but we get lots of wood chips. The local tree fellers are very generous to us, and sometimes they'll drop us off a truckload of wood chips, which we mix through to keep our carbon-nitrogen ratio correct in our compost bins.
That's important.
Very important, yes. The biggest mistake people make in making compost is not enough carbon. And the little microorganisms that break down the organic matter and turn it into beautiful soil, they need more carbon than nitrogen. So it's very good, volume-wise, to keep your carbon level at over 50%, 50 to 70%. And that way you're going to have a very rich and nutrient-rich carbon compost.
Can you just explain what carbon, where you get this carbon from?
So carbon, that is, think dry, brown, So it's things like wood chips. And a lot of people say, well, I don't have wood chips. Well, you always have a supply of newspaper or cardboard. That's also carbon, pure carbon. But you can also use dry leaves. Leaves are a wonderful source of carbon. So all the dry brown things, that's your carbon source. And your nitrogen source is your weeds, your green stuff, food scraps, your seaweed from the beach, anything that is, it's usually more wet. It's usually wet, greenish, and nitrogen rich. The tea that we put in, that's a bit of a mixture, it's probably half-half.
And the percentage again?
Between 50 and 70% carbon, you need to keep it above 50%.
Very good.
And if you have too much carbon, the composting process stops and it just sits there. So if you have a whole heap of just brown stuff, nothing much happens. It takes ages. And if you don't, if you have too much nitrogen, that is not enough carbon, then it goes slimy, smelly, anaerobic.
Yes, I'm aware of the Bokashi method and anaerobic. Do you turn it a lot?
We don't tend to turn it much at the community garden. There's two ways to make compost. You do the batch system, which makes hot compost. So that means you make a big batch all at once and you put it all together. So you've stockpiled your materials, you make it all, put it all together. That usually is good to turn it and then it heats up again. But we do it the other way. The continuous flow. So whatever we have this week, we put on the pile. Next week, we'll put a bit more on the pile and good layers of carbon and nitrogen. And we just leave it. It takes longer, six months maybe a wee bit longer, sometimes shorter, but you still get compost. So we tend to do it the lazy way, not making a batch at a time, the hot composting way.
This is very good, Trish. Yeah, lovely information. Because Richard Main, here in Auckland City, he was brought in by the Manukau District Health Board to start off 50 cooperative gardens. I actually applied for that as well, but I missed out yet again. But Richard took over, and he was the best man for it. And I know there's far more than 50 cooperative gardens and community gardens, and I can't emphasize enough that this is the way you can wake up in the morning knowing that you have got something to look forward to, people to look forward to. You get wonderful, healthy, vital food, but you also pick up many different recipes because there are so many different cultures and nationalities involved in these cooperative community gardens. And so you have a wonderful meal at the end of the day that you've never experienced before.
I think that's the most wonderful thing about our community garden in Matakana, is the lovely social contact. I mean, I really look forward to my Monday mornings at the Matakana Community Garden. You get to interact with some the loveliest people. Gardeners are great people. And share tips, share recipes. It's just a lovely social occasion every Monday, yeah. And the other wonderful thing that we have going in Matakana is a weekly green swap. Well, it's weekly in summer, and I'm an active member of that. It was started about 10 years ago, not by me, by somebody else. And so we meet in the village once a week for a half an hour. It's very short, sweet. Everyone brings the surplus produce from their gardens and we swap. So no money changes hands. People just swap. And again, it's a lovely social occasion. We have usually between 6 and 20 people show up and everyone presents what they've got and gives possibly a recipe that goes with it. Or if no one's got any produce, if someone's got no produce, they might bring along some jam or some cakes or something like that. And we all swap. And there's such a lovely generosity of spirit about these people. And you build these lovely networks. And then in summer, once a month, we have a home visit. So we'll be invited to someone's home. We can look around their garden, see their produce, have morning tea. So it takes a little bit longer once a month. In winter, people don't have so much produce in their garden, so we cut it down to once a fortnight. And then as soon as the gardens are cranking again in spring, we go back to once a week.
It's a gentle reciprocity and goodwill. And it's delightful. This is the true nature of our being, really, isn't it?
It's wonderful. We have people, new people, coming to the area. And they come along and they just think this is the most wonderful thing. They come along to meet people, to get to know people. And they just love it. Yeah, and this is something very much in the line of the community building in permaculture. So,
very much so. I've done interviews around Project Littleton in South Island, and again, they are too. A whole large group of people working in this little tiny town of Littleton, and they've got so many things going that all is based around just community people doing, being, living, sharing, cooperating and collaborating. It's just a wonderful thing, and we want to be able to see this happen all over New Zealand, and the sooner the better.
Definitely. I think it really enriches a community. It's a great way of networking, exchanging information. And the people that come to our Green Swap, they're very much into zero waste. Nobody arrives with a plastic bag at our Green Swap. They arrive with baskets laden with produce. So there's already a great, how can I call it, certain unspoken principles people have taken on. You know that the people have grown the produce organically without pesticides. You know they're bringing it along zero waste without plastics. I think it's a small way that we can live the change we want to see in the world.
It's the only way. We have to model it, particularly for children. When they see us walking our talk, it makes a huge difference. And again, getting children back into the garden, away from their devices, is an imperative in this day and age.
Absolutely. We've got some parents who come along to the community garden and bring their kids, and they help harvesting and planting, and that it's just a delight having them there. Yeah. And the children are the future. I mean, look what's happening in the world today with the young people realizing what's happening with climate change and taking action. They get it. It's their future. It gives me so much hope to see these young people standing up to make a change and demanding that
we address.
Yes.
Yes, what I find, I'm all for the millennials at the moment. I want to get behind them because we've bequeathed them something that they didn't expect. And the baby boomers have to really stand up and be counted now. I'm also hammering the baby boomers, my generation, because they've had their cake and eat it too. And as far as I'm concerned, they're not giving the children a chance because they're not factoring every decision that they make into their future. And so this is another thing. At the political level, I look around and I see there's not one world leader who has said, let's factor children into all our decisions. Nobody's saying this. And so, yes, again, we need to be a little bit more strident in some ways to make sure that we support the future, because the children of today are going to be our leaders in 40, 50 years' time. And I want leadership who are aware, who have felt empowered and supported, so that they will also take care of us as they then take care of the future into the 22nd century.
Yes, I feel that change is afoot, Tim. You look at the young people now, they're going to strike for action on climate change. This is something immense. And the young Swedish girl who stood up in the UN, it's just amazing. They're going to demand that things change. And this is really, really encouraging. And it's really good to have models of things that work, that have been tried and true, like permaculture, that they can look to in the future, I think.
Agree with you 100%. New Zealand is basically 15 years behind the Europeans when it comes to recycling. And the Japanese have been doing this for near on 30 years. I was in Japan, and everything is in their proper containers outside their gate. New Zealand and the Auckland Council have not stepped up yet, and there's a necessity for everybody in New Zealand to get in behind this initiative that you're doing. Now, Trish, there's a fermentation workshop on the 23rd of March at the Matakana Hall. The fermentation makes me wonder, which was interesting. They'll be able to do their own kombucha, no doubt.
Yes.
Very good. And there's hot composting and biochar workshops on the 31st of March at the Rainbow Valley Farm, which is about 3.5-4K along the
Matakana Valley Road.
Yeah, Matakana Valley Road. And you can also get on, if you wanted to book at www.kaipatiki.org.nz/EcoFest. I'll say it again, kaipatiki.org.nz/EcoFest. Matakana and the Matakana Hall are not too far away, which to people living in Auckland, that's north by something like about 75-80 kilometres north of Auckland. It doesn't take you too long to get there. Yes, oh, Trish, you're a wealth of information. This has been a very enjoyable interview. It's a great connection too, because I've seen you from time to time in Matakana, and we might just get together for a few words and a hug. But lovely that you continue to commit to the dream that we are going to turn this whole game plan around, and the children of today and tomorrow are going to have a future, because it's grassroots, it's nature, it's rainbows, butterflies, Mother Earth, flowers, and really going back to the garden.
Back to nature. And as I started this interview with Tim, once you're bitten by the permaculture bug, it's permanent.
I see. And that permaculture bug is one that only eats not of our garden. This is wonderful, Trish. And I'm going to put the interview of Joe that I did way back at the bottom of the write-up so that people can listen to you, and they can then just click on a button and listen to Joe telling us way back about how he and you made Rainbow Valley such a successful permaculture farm and icon for the world.
Thank you, Tim. It was lovely to be here and to talk with you.
Thank you, Trish. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Trish, there was just one thing that you wanted to mention, and this was biological farming in New Zealand. And I've interviewed many people, Graham Saint, Arden Anderson, Christine Jones, and Dr. Phil Gregory. This is the new way forward for particularly dairy farmers and sheep farmers.
Exactly. This is very exciting, Tim. This is one of the things that makes me so hopeful for the future, because biological farming has so many solutions to our current use of unsustainable phosphate that's brought from the other side of the world. And this is just a system of farming, easy to do, that any farmer can do. And many farmers are climbing on board now. And it's about looking after the microorganisms in the soil. It's a certain management technique with the animals so that you never graze the grass right down very, very low. Because when that happens, the roots shorten up.
That's it.
And the grass takes so much longer to recover. So if you do this long grazing system, you've got the long root. The plant can regenerate so much more quickly. And at the same time, the exudates from the plant roots are feeding the microorganisms in the soil, and the microorganisms in the soil are feeding the plant. So you're building soil, you're building carbon in the soil. It's also known as carbon farming. There's the most massive potential to sequester carbon in soils and grazing land through this system. So biological farming, I recommend the farmers look it up. Many farmers are starting to get interested. I went to field days a few years ago down near Hamilton, and they had a wonderful woman talking about it, and it was full of farmers, and I thought this was very, very exciting and very encouraging.
Thanks, Trish. It's also mentioned regenerative farming is another word they use.
Yes, carbon farming, regenerative farming, biological farming, yes, it's called a number of different names.
Yes, thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
To listen to my early 2008 interview of Joe Palacia, you can go to planetaudio.org.nz, go into English, then Green Planet Archives. Scroll to the bottom and you will find Joe at the top of number 2. Thank you. That was Trish Allen on Permaculture. Next week, I'm going to be interviewing Darren Doherty. He's from Australia and Bendigo in Victoria, and he is the leader in a system called Regrarianism, Regrarian Agriculture. And you can get to his website at regrarian.org. Regrarian.org. This is the next level up in some ways. It's a very holistic method of working with the land and working and making your farm, your garden, your way of life and nature so much more enjoyable. The outcomes are to produce stable environments with sound watersheds, restore profitability via integrated and regenerative agriculture development and management, increase wildlife species and numbers of species and stability of populations, improve soil and vegetation resources of cities, industry and agriculture right across the whole area, to re-establish riverine and riparian areas, to prevent waste of financial, human and natural resources, to entrench holistic decision-making frameworks and regrarian design and planning with principles within the education system and communities and organizations, and to develop viable decentralized energy production systems, restore local, regional and global mineral and water cycles, and provide value to their collaborators and course participants and clients and community. It is a complete sort of, I don't like using the word package, but it is a way of being working with the whole of community, with all biota, working in regional areas of the biosphere and localizing our way of life to be really present on the land, breathing in the air, taking in the pure crystal water that you would want to drink, and working the soil with its microbes and microflora, the bacteria and fungi, to make your area a little garden paradise for you to be able to produce nutrient-dense organic food and to have a home where your family and your friends and your community can come and participate and enjoy life and recognize how we are connected to Mother Earth and essentially experience joy while surviving in these very changing of times. That's Darren Doherty of regrarians.org. I invite you to be able to come to greenplanetfm.com, where we have over 400 interviews in our database, which you can readily download and listen to. to be able to inspire yourself to become the change you want to see in the world. And become involved in caring for your children and grandchildren's future. We are also on Facebook, on Green Planet FM and ourplanet.org. Please come and love us. This is Tim Lynch.
And Lisa Eyre.
And Liz Gunn.
In the spirit of...